We've got the need to podcast. This is episode 28, Mission Impossible 3 from 2006. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And with us tonight, we have back from a couple episodes of Cruise Club ago, we have Mr. Dan Colon. Hello, Dan.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me back.
Thank you for being back. And as we continue to go to Mission Impossible movies with a new director, a new hired gun, we are bringing in our own hired gun to talk about the movies. So welcome, Mr. J.J. Abrams, apparently, Dan Colon.
Is that who I am representing in this episode?
In a way, absolutely.
Okay, sure, I'll take it.
I do not want to talk about another movie that J.J. Abrams has made recently, because I feel like we could get derailed, and I also don't actually have thoughts about that. But I will say, I am so tired of J.J. Abrams giving me not nearly enough Kerry Russell in his goddamn movies. Like, why are you going to put her in a movie for 5 minutes and not give me, like, an hour of Kerry Russell?
Because it's reminding you to go watch all of Felicity. That's where you find your Kerry
Russell. Yeah, I had the exact same reaction, and I had to remember that this was before The Americans, correct? So, like,
yes.
Kerry Russell was just sort of dug up out of obscurity. She hadn't really done much at this point, and we get, like...
Well, she did Felicity. She starred in all of Felicity that J.J. Abrams created.
Sure, but what I'm saying is when this movie came out, she hadn't done much recently.
Oh, recently? Yeah, okay.
Right, so we had gotten, like, 15 minutes of Kerry Russell, and, like, what the hell? But we look at that now in 2019 eyes, and we've gotten how many seasons of The Americans? We've gotten countless other things. She's incredible. Mm-hmm. But at the time, yeah, I don't know that people were yearning for more Kerry Russell. Maybe they were. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it looks like Felicity ended in 2002, and then she was in a movie called The Upside of Anger, and then a TV movie called The Magic of Ordinary Days, then a TV miniseries, one episode, and then she was in this. So, like, basically, in the 4 years between those things, she was in, like, two or three things. So, yeah, not really a lot. And then she would go on to be in Running Wild. Oh, that was, wow. Man, there's, like, a gap in my, Waitress was the next year. Okay, so this might be sort of her return to Hollywood in a way.
Right.
Before we go further, not that we're really talking about Mission Impossible 3, but before we talk about Mission Impossible 3, let me give a quick plot rundown. Again, this feels like a kind of simple plot, but also wildly complex just because it is Mission Impossible 3. But here is what this movie is about if you have not seen it, directed by J.J. Abrams. The movie starts in a way that is my least favorite thing in all movies. We are in the climactic scene. Philip Seymour Hoffman has a gun to Michelle Monaghan's head, is saying to Tom Cruise, "Give me the rabbit's foot." Don't know what that is. Spoiler, never know what the rabbit's foot is, really, other than
right.
Maybe the anti-god. Gun to Michelle Monaghan's head, give me the rabbit foot or she dies. We don't know who she is. Clearly, Tom Cruise cares about her. We then flash cut back to their engagement party, and Tom Cruise is getting married to a woman that we have never met before in the Mission Impossible movies. She is a nurse, Julia, played by Michelle Monaghan. He gets a call to take a trip to Mexico, finds out that one of his students, because now Ethan Hunt is sort of retired, and he's more of an instructor than a field agent. One of his, maybe his first student, one of his favorite students, Kerry Russell, this agent named Lindsay, has been taken as she's tried to track down Philip Seymour Hoffman, and so he has to go save her. So along with Maggie Q and Jonathan Rhys Meyers, who Mike would go on later to play Elvis and I think win awards for some Elvis miniseries or something. I don't know. Go check out Viva Pod Vegas. And Luther, Ving Rhames, they go and they get sent to Europe to find the rabbit's foot, which Simon Pegg, in this movie, he is here for the first time, thinks might be the anti-god. Cruise gets married before they go. They go to Italy. They go to the Vatican, where Philip Seymour Hoffman and his buyers are there to broker this deal for the rabbit's foot. They steal the rabbit's foot, or they steal the coordinates for the rabbit's foot. We find out via a postcard, which has some technology embedded in it, that Kerry Russell thinks that Lawrence Fishburne, who is their boss, has been working with Philip Seymour Hoffman, sort of betraying the IMF, betraying the American people. Later, we find out that it's actually Billy Crudup, sort of the mid-level boss, because of course it's going to be Billy Crudup. Like, in what movie would Lawrence Fishburne be the bad guy over Billy Crudup? But either way, I digress.
Running with the Devil?
Check out the Cage Club Awards, which we posted a couple weeks ago, where Mike gave some love to Lawrence Fishburne in that movie. They think that Ethan is a rogue agent because of what he's... Basically because it's a Mission Impossible movie, and Tom Cruise does things that don't exactly align with the IMF, which I've learned in this movie is the Impossible Mission Force, which is... okay.
yeah, but he's always got to be on the run for a while, at least.
So he gets arrested, and they bring him in, and Billy Crudup's like, here, I'm going to tell you where the rabbit's foot is, because by this point, Philip Strumhoffman has abducted, Michelle Monaghan has abducted Jules, and Cruz needs to, he has 48 hours to get the rabbit's foot so he can get Jules back. Hoo boy, they go to Shanghai, and he gets the rabbit's foot. We don't see him actually get the rabbit's foot, we're just outside as Maggie Q and Jonathan Rhys Meyers are basically praying for his success. There's a huge long foot race atop a roof along a river. Ethan finds Jules, but then Philip Seymour Hoffman kills her. Or this is before, I don't know. He kills her, but then we find out that it's not. This is so overly complex. But then he kills Julia. He kills Jules, but it's not actually Jules. It's his own teammate. This is not helping anybody who has not seen the movie, I just realized. Anyway, in the end, they save the day. Tom Cruise says a line, I have a charge in my head. I'm going to die unless you kill me, which is super cool. Jules kills him, defends them, brings him back to life.
Dies and comes back. I couldn't believe it.
They kill Billy Crudup. They get the rabbit's foot. They go back. They give Lawrence Fishburne. Everybody is happy. Tom Cruise gets accommodations. Tom Cruise is like, what's the rabbit's foot? He's like, if you promise me you'll stay, I'll let you know. And he's like, sorry, man, going on my honeymoon. And they just leave. And that's the end of the movie. So basically, bad things happen. Tom Cruise saves the world. Everybody's happy in the end. That's kind of the short of it. But I'm so sorry that that did not actually help anyone who has not actually seen this movie.
I have to wonder how many people are going to listen to this specific episode who have never seen this movie.
Well, I think that's a question. Why would anybody listen to any of these unless you've seen the movie? But I'm sure there's people out there who have found this for one reason or another who have listened to every episode of Cruise Club. I don't know. Email us, run@cageclub.me if you've not seen it. If these plot summaries help, I don't know that they do, but it's a Mission Impossible movie. Like, he does crazy things, he does spectacular stunts, and death-defying, you know, special effects and whatever. In the end, the world is saved. Except in this one, he gets married, so that's a difference.
Yeah, you know, he's given a mission, he has to form a team, he has to save the world. Like, it's kind of a Mad Libs from there on out, which is fine, because, like, those core ingredients that they have to this franchise, I feel like, work so well just, you know, on their own. And I just, like, everybody that they've got for the team is great. I love everybody they always picked for the villains. I mean, it's got a formula. Like, Bond has a formula, like, every couple films, you know, sort of the same situations over and over again. But we don't care. I love that stuff, you know, because it's always a new Bond or something going through old situations. So, you know, out of the three so far, Joey, you might be surprised to hear this is my least favorite.
No, I'm not surprised, because I was actually just going to ask you where that is, but I want you to finish your thoughts. I have a thought about that too.
I still like it, but I think that's what I'm coasting on is sort of my love of the last two of watching them so soon together, because this feels sort of I want more confusion. I want more stuff going on. I feel like it might be a little too bare, a little too
because this is pretty straightforward, right?
A little too straightforward, like, perhaps. Yeah.
My summary did not really, I don't think, explain, but this is a pretty straightforward movie. It's a short movie. It's you know, without credits, under 2 hours. I think a lot of the conversation that you and I had with Austin Wolf Southern, who was on our Mission Impossible 2 episode, was about how that one sort of had, like, a weird rap for being by far the worst one. But, like, of the three, I think the first one still is leaps and bounds above the other two. Mm-hmm. I think that this one I have very slightly above two. But, like, as far as I'm concerned, they're kind of the same to me. Like, they're both good. I enjoy watching both, but I don't think one is necessarily way better than the other or way worse than the other. I think they're about the same. I know that we're going to get to Fallout, which might be my favorite Tom Cruise movie. We're going to reach really, really, really high highs, and I'm excited to watch Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation and Fallout. Like, I'm excited to get to those, but I'm right there with you, Mike. I think that this is not, you know, it's not leaps and bounds above two in a way that other people either condemn two for being or praise three for being, I guess.
For me, what it comes down to is basically the style between the three films. Like, I think this is just a lesser crafted production. It feels more rushed. Like, I don't exactly like the way it looks and is shot. And so I think for those reasons alone, like, it just is a little under two for me, because I just think one and two look so incredible and have such amazing shots and sequences, whereas this one doesn't really, JJ doesn't really measure up to John Woo. And, you know, I don't feel bad for saying that at all.
There's a lot of trivia that I will get to toward the end of the show about, not, you know, disclaimers for why this isn't as good as it could be or should be or whatever, but there were a lot of, like, weird delays, and, you know, JJ was not the first pick in terms of director, and it seemed like there was a lot of production issues and different directors attached and different writers attached, and like what we saw with the War of the Worlds thing with Cruise jumping on Oprah's couch. Like, there's some weird kind of personal stuff, and there's, like, Scientology stuff that I'll get to. So, like, there's a lot of things behind the scenes here. In sort of in spite of all that, I think this is a very good movie, but I sort of have like reasons or like, again, I don't know if it's the right word, but disclaimers why it maybe is as sort of not as put together maybe as the first two. I don't know. But Dan, without going too far down the rabbit hole into the movies that we have not gotten to yet, do you have the first two in your head fresh enough to sort of, where does this stack compared to the first two? Do you have a favorite of the first three in this franchise?
As you guys were talking, I pulled up the, I have a list on Letterboxd where I ranked all of the Mission Impossibles. I couldn't remember specifically where I put Mission Impossible 3. I just rewatched it to discuss it with you guys, and I had always remembered enjoying it more than I should have, and I did rank it second to last above Mission Impossible 2. But I don't think that that is indicative of how I feel about it as a whole. I think that the first Mission Impossible is far and away the best Mission Impossible.
Oh, so that's your number one
overall. It is my number one overall. It has not changed. The last time I rewatched that, I just couldn't believe how tight and incredible that was as a spy thriller. Now, as an action movie, it's not so great, right? It was marketed as an action movie. It's not really an action movie. But I think that overall, it is a more effective film than the others are. As the series progressed, you know, it became a franchise of action. You know, what can we throw Tom Cruise off of? What can he run through or off of or whatever? You know, it became about these stunts. So I think that first one is still far and away the best.
Now, when you describe, you have it next to last, but you don't think that it's necessarily indicative of like how much you enjoy watching it. I don't want to give a plug to another podcast that I talk about too much.
Sure.
But like we say with The Fast and the Furious, with Too Fast, Too Forever, like even a bad one of those movies is still a movie that I'm going to enjoy watching more than most other movies. Like this is not, I don't think, a bad, like I think it'd be hard pressed for people to say like this is a bad movie, but in the grand scheme of Mission Impossible movies, I can see where you're saying like it doesn't stack up, it doesn't compare, but it's still a fun movie that is worth watching and enjoyable to watch just because of the nature of these movies and the spectacle and sort of the spy nature of all this sort of, like it's a fun movie.
Right. I think that, so just to kind of give a broad overview of my view of the franchise. I think the first one, again, really tight spy thriller. And then John Woo did a great job with the action in MI2, but the story really just loses me. And I don't think that that was as strong as it could have been. When I saw Mission Impossible 3, I think J.J. Abrams took the best of the first Mission Impossible and the second Mission Impossible and then sort of created this new thing that could satisfy the people who wanted the spy stuff, people who wanted cool gadgets and whatnot, and kick-ass action. I don't think it does either as well as the first two, but it reaches a happy medium that overall left me really satisfied. And I think that it's what J.J. Abrams does, is he takes these franchises that have fallen to the wayside in some way, revises them or gives them new energy, and then sets them loose, right? So he's done it with Star Trek, he's done it with Mission Impossible, and he's done it with Star Wars. He's a good guy to bring things back to center and then give them a launching off point to find themselves a little more. And I think that that's why I rank 3 second from last, because it's since 3, the franchise has really found its way and it's become better and more entertaining using the formula that J.J. Abrams created with Mission Impossible 3.
Yeah, no, and I see that too. You know, I see how it's like the sort of trying to take the best of both worlds and like give you a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Yeah, I don't think that first Mission Impossible is a franchise film. Like, we're not going to build a franchise off of that. I think it's a very solid thriller, but in order to create the franchise, I think J.J. Abrams had to step in and then take what's best from both of those first two and then go off.
Yeah, and I do remember when this came out, like, people saying, oh, look, like, J.J. sort of saved it, or not saved it necessarily, but just saying, like, it's better now, or, like, going forward, like, people want more of this Mission Impossible. They maybe sort of got a little lost in the stuff that I preferred with all the espionage, but, like, yeah, it just speaks more toward a mass audience of just, like, we just want the action. But I think after these are my favorite ones, where they really, like, take that formula, and it seems like they're trying to chart something in advance, right? And, like, it really, those feel more like the ongoing serial as opposed to like a single movie or something like that. And so I do love where they take it from here, and it does feel sort of like maybe a soft reboot or something.
I think what's kind of interesting about the serialized nature, like I agree with you, like they want to have movies like aside from Luther and Tom Cruise, like there's no continuation, right? Like everybody is kind of new from movie to movie so far in the first three, and they wanted, like we talked about with Mission Impossible 2, they wanted Thandie Newton to come back for this one. She chose to spend more time with her family, so they kind of rewrote her character, and then they, I think, combined characters and dropped characters out, and there's a whole bunch of, like, who almost was. So I think they tried to have a little bit more serialized nature here, but then that didn't happen. And then between different rewrites and stuff like that, I think it just kind of became its own thing. But now we know that Jules, spoiler for future Mission Impossible movies, is kind of an important character for the rest of the franchise, right? Like, she is his North Star in a lot of ways, right? Even as things happen in their relationship or whatever, she is kind of the through line. And then now that we have Luther, we have Benji, yeah, the Benji team is in place too, right? And so it's kind of a combination of a couple different things, maybe just making them a little bit closer together, because it's been 10 years now since the first one, and then in the next 10 years we're gonna have another three. So, like, it, you know, it just sort of feels like they're making them a little bit closer together, and so maybe that helps things. I don't know, but I do agree with you that it becomes more of a continuation as opposed to just like, oh, here's another mission.
Yeah, I think it's exciting because it proved that this can work as just an action franchise if you want it to, right? So, like, you know, the first two movies are different in that regard, in that it's much more spy stuff, and this has it, but this is much louder, and there's way more, like, camera activity, like, kinetic activity just in general in this film, and right, and it just goes like, oh, you could do one episode of this where it is like this, and then get back to sort of seeping in more espionage down the line with the other films as they do, and they find, like, the nice balance along the way.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it is also in another way, like, the Fast and Furious franchise, where, like, Tokyo Drift is its own thing, and Too Fast is kind of its own thing, and then basically by the time four and five
is the
roll around,
one.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. It's just like, here, we're gonna start, like, these all mean something now. There are, you know, villains are linked, and the stories are linked, and the characters are the same, as opposed to individualized stories within a world. We're going to tell this overarching narrative over the course of several movies that each stand alone, but they also play a bigger role in the grand scheme of things, which I think is I think that's just maybe the ever evolving nature of a franchise that isn't a horror franchise, maybe, just, you know, instead of just having new people to kill, it's just, how can we do more with these? Like, how do we have, like, the Marvel movies, how do we have them be on their own but also contribute to the bigger picture? How do we do that with the Fast and Furious? How do we do the Mission Impossible? So, movie franchises that really aspire to greatness in their own way, I think, no disrespect to horror franchises or whatever, I think it's a natural progression of things to do what the Mission Impossible movies do. So, but Dan, let's start with you. If you had to pick a favorite moment or character or scene or line or whatever, what is your favorite part of Mission Impossible 3?
One of my favorite things about this movie is the addition of Simon Pegg as Benji. One of the things I love about this franchise from 3 forward is how much it does classic James Bond better than James Bond does these days. I'm like a huge James Bond fan. You know, when you look at those old movies, you know, it's fun to watch the silly gadgets, and you got Q, who's always got the thing for the situation, right? And Benji as a character just sort of cuts through a lot of the drama of this franchise in a way that makes the movie really fun, and always provides this, you know, funny quips or a fun gadget that will come in handy in some weird, outrageous way. I really love Simon Pegg in this, because I think without him, the movie, it's still fun, but I think that it needs, you need to be able to laugh at it in order to really fully enjoy it. And I think he really brings that energy to the cast that allows you to have that sort of fun with it, if that makes sense.
Totally. Like, I love him in this, too. Like, I was pretty shocked that he popped up in this at the time, because I think I mean, American audiences had, this is their introduction to Simon Pegg. Like, I think we might have known him from Shaun of the Dead, like, maybe a year or two before this, and, like, I didn't even really know about that show Spaced, I don't think, until, like, seeing this movie. So he just felt like a natural fit, you know, and he's, like, sort of the Q, but not really. He's, like, their go-to techie, I guess. Like, I love that, too, like, how tech-heavy this franchise is, and to find, like, he's a hacker maybe better than Luther or something like that is, like, a pretty exciting character to bring in here.
The only version of this character that we've had prior to this is Emilio Estevez in Mission Impossible 1, you know, and yeah, he's kind of funny, you know, with the gum, like, don't chew it. Simon Pegg just has a natural comedic timing, and I think that really adds this fresh, funny element in this movie that works in favor of it, doesn't stand out in a bad way. You know, like, I don't know what it is. I think he overall just pushes the tone in just the right direction so we can take all the drama seriously, but still have fun and laugh.
Now, how would you feel if the Benji character was played by Ricky Gervais, who almost was cast in this role?
Are you having a laugh? Are you serious? Oh my gosh.
I used to be a big fan of Ricky Gervais, and then I feel like as a culture, we kind of got tired of him. And, you know, I think back in 06, I think he still would have been good, but I'm glad that Simon Pegg has stuck around because I really like him, and I think that he works so well in this world. But there was also a joke that when he was becoming... After Shaun of the Dead was so successful, Simon Pegg was asked if he'd pursue a career in Hollywood, because that was, you know, sort of an independent British movie. And he laughed and said, it's not like I'm going to be in Mission Impossible 3, which, you know, where he wound up, which I think is kind of funny. You would look at him or a guy like Ricky Gervais and be like, oh, they don't fit in this world. But, like, you need the people, the man in the chair, right? Like, you need the support. And he's so perfect in the humor, in the technical ability, in the personality. Like, it all blends so well, and I do agree with you, Dan. Like, I love him in these movies.
I also think that, unlike Ricky Gervais, who tends to lean into the cynical kind of humor that I don't think would really fit well in this franchise, you know, I think Simon Pegg, in a lot of ways, when you watch this franchise going forward, he is almost an audience surrogate. Like, how many times have we watched these movies, like, wanting to wear the mask, you know? Like, every movie they make these masks to replicate, you know, to impersonate somebody else. And it's like, oh man, how cool would it be to get to wear that mask? And then I think in Ghost Protocol, he wants to wear the mask. He wants to get involved, but, you know, he's not a field guy, and neither are we. So he shares our enthusiasm while also, you know, not getting to have a lot of that fun. And then when he does get to have that fun, we get to have fun with him. So I think that him being a real life nerd, it really shows through in that performance and, you know, infects me as an audience member. Like, oh man, I want to, like, he's who I would be in this movie. So I think that's a real big part of what he brings to Benji and what Benji brings to the franchise.
I think he also just works so well. Like, again, kind of to the point from earlier, Mike, about how it becomes more serialized. I don't know if he was a character that was sort of considered to stick around, but I feel like just the fun he has in the limited scenes, like that one phone call he has with Tom Cruise toward the end, it's just, you almost can't get rid of him. Like, he's so charming and just works so well, bounces off, like, his sort of professionalism, but silliness, while Tom Cruise is serious and, like, is able to be effective at his job. Like, it all blends so well.
Yeah, he makes it a problem, like, to get rid of him, right? Like, he just, I don't know, like, he just has, like, so much charisma and stuff, and, like, keeping him around is such a smart idea because it just links it more going forward. Like, oh, look, like, he was in the chair and now he's in training, and now he's in another movie, he'll be a field agent, and then he'll be really integral to the plot of future movie and stuff. And so it's just really cool to see how they could take, not like sort of a one scene character and build him up into, like, something they can't do without, really. Like, if they killed off Benji in the next movie, I'd be like, oh my God.
Yeah, I think his presence is beneficial, if only so, you know, every ridiculous stunt Tom Cruise does, he's the guy who can react to it. Like, we watch Tom Cruise, you know, climb into a plane as it's taking off, you know, whatever. And Simon Pegg is there with the real life response to that. Like, oh my God, you're climbing into a plane as it's taking off. Or, oh my God, you're climbing up the world's tallest building. Or, oh my God, you know, whatever. Benji is the character that reacts the way we react. And that's what I love about him.
And then it tells you that, yes, even you can train to be a field agent if you try hard enough.
Mike, what about you? Is there a favorite? What's your favorite part of Mission Impossible 3?
I really want to say the running part, but it's like too short of a moment there. But that, what a terrific run when we get to the run.
Oh, we're going to end the awards, but, oh, for sure. We will be mentioning that run. I can tell you that much.
Even though I was surprised how little he's in the movie, I got to say the presence of Philip Seymour Hoffman as a villain is, like, insane. Like, he is so good in this, and it just makes me miss him and, like, all that kind of wish we had more. And it's just, like, so great that he is in a Mission Impossible movie, because he's not necessarily, I mean until, like, Hunger Games, really, you know, that was much later, but I feel, but, like, he wasn't a big franchise guy, you know, so it's just, like, such a treat to have him in a Mission Impossible movie for any amount of time, really. And to have, you know, even though I wish that scene came when it was supposed to instead of in the opening, that's such an amazing scene between him and Tom Cruise in the opening. The stuff in the airplane is great. When he, you know, I know Kyle over at Foodie Films got to shout him and his Hoff bro Brian out, because I know they love that line that he gives in the airplane about, like, I'm going to find her, I'm going to hurt her, like, all that. Like, oh my God, his presence here is just insane. And he kicks the shit out of Tom Cruise at the end. I totally forgot that he, like, overpowers him. He's like, I'll put a bomb in your head. And then he just proceeds to beat the shit out of him until he gets carred over in the middle of the street. But just so cool that he's here.
And I know that it's with the mask, and I know that it's supposed to be Tom Cruise, but I loved Philip Seymour Hoffman kind of as action star. Like, I know it's also a stunt double, probably a body mm-hmm. double, whatever, but, like, him going, like, climbing the rafters and everything, like, it just, it's so cool to see. You know, I'm not as invested in his career as Kyle and Brian are, but I did like seeing him here as a villain, and I thought it was cool to see sort of two sides of him. And also when Tom Cruise is him and he's just like, hey, what's up? Like, just like completely out of character for the character, but also in character for Tom Cruise. Like, it's just the blend and the way that they use the masks, which are not that frequent in this movie. I think there's two masks, if I'm right. There's this one, the big one in the middle, and then when he's using his translator as Julia, I think those are the only masks. I mean, we see the mask, we see the proverbial sausage getting made here, right? But, like, the masks seem to play a lower impact, lesser impact in this movie than previous movies, especially after two, where there was, like, five or whatever, like, crazy amounts. I love what they do with the mask, both narratively later, but also, you know, just with for fun and for action, for effect here.
Yeah, that's a great scene. I'm so glad we finally got to see that after three movies, like, how they, like, in the field, they 3D print the mask and how he, like, puts it on his face. And that's a great little couple of trick effect shots of Tom Cruise turning into Philip Seymour Hoffman. And I love when he's like, we got married last week, and he's like Philip Seymour Hoffman as Tom Cruise, or Tom Cruise as Philip Seymour Hoffman as Tom Cruise, like, gives that little, like, Tom Cruise smirk. It's just so on point, and, like, has all of his mannerisms down. It's just so much fun.
Yeah, I really loved watching the mask get made, because, you know, that's such a big part of the franchise that I felt like after three, like, by the third movie, we should be able to see that machine.
I think there's a lot of those kind of examples in this movie where JJ is like when they're trying to capture Philip Seymour Hoffman's voice, and he says, read this card. It basically captures all of the sounds in human speech in a short amount of time. So when he reads this thing that, like, I'm Busby's friend, blah, 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 it's all these different sounds that are able to, the computer can translate that into, and that's when, you know, he's coughing as Philip Seymour Hoffman, and he's just like, while they're uploading the voice to his chip in his neck or whatever, right? It's that same kind of thing where it's, we might have seen that before, but I feel like this is kind of peeking behind the curtain, and as we add Benji here and we add more tech guys to the team, we're sort of seeing more of the tech in action and more in effect, and we're sort of seeing how they're doing things, as opposed to, like, it's almost like a Penn and Teller style, like, it's still magic, but we're sort of seeing how the magic is being done, which I think is kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, it's cool that they actually made that part of, like, the story or part of the tension and stuff like that, right? It's like, oh, okay, so in order for everybody, I guess, in order to have someone sound like alike, they need this sentence or phrase on file somewhere, and since this is, like, in the field, there's, like, a limited amount of time to get it. So it's, like, really cool how they're like, this is how, not only is this how it's done, but, like, we're under the gun, and it's, like, adding, you know, to everything going on, to all the action and stuff. So it's really well played. It's not like they're just saying, okay, you have to get him to read this in order to sound like him. You know, it's cool.
It was a brilliant move to give us a glimpse behind the curtain, but not just do that to do it, but to create a dramatic moment out of that. I think that's one of the most tense moments in the movie, you know, when he's waiting for that to upload, and he's got to, like, communicate to the bodyguard, like, don't come in here. And what brilliant acting on Philip Seymour Hoffman's part in that scene. So, yeah, I think just a great, great moment, and great way to handle that material.
The tension there between, one, Philip Seymour Hoffman being held behind the door, right, by Jonathan mm-hmm. Rhys-Davies, mm-hmm. and then having the other Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's actually Tom Cruise, but it's still Philip Seymour Hoffman acting, coughing, holding the guy with his hand, like, just the command he has of the room there, both as an actor and both as the, you know, the villain in the scene, it's phenomenal.
And that's really good directing on JJ's part. Like, I think that's one of the best sequences because of how well planned out it must have been and how many storyboards they must have had, you know, because later on when we get to, you know, some of my complaints, they have to do, I think, with some of the camera work and the framing and the directing.
You know, like, I love Thandie Newton in the last movie, but I think that we were kind of lamenting that she was a bit sidelined, and I think that in all these movies that everyone who's not Tom Cruise is going to be sidelined in one way or another. I do want to say that my favorite part of this movie might just be the presence of all the different women. Like, I think that none of them necessarily has a ton to do, and especially I was lamenting that Kerry Russell basically has nothing to do, but she is badass in this movie, like in her one action scene that she trained 3 months to do. Michelle Monaghan at the end, she's not to say just a nurse, as in being a nurse isn't important, but like she's just a nurse and she's not a spy, but she's able to kill a couple guys and defend her and Tom Cruise. Maggie Q here is just phenomenal too. I think each of their small parts could be bigger. I would like to see them do more as they diversify the team and as they bring in more people. I think seeing more women in these movies is cool. I think it's great to see here, and especially, you know, when we get to Fallout, we get to Vanessa Kirby, you know, my darling Hattie Shaw from Hobbs and Shaw, you know, it's going to take things even to the next level. But I think that in this movie, there's such a, I think it almost seemed, it had to be intentional almost, right? Like, let's have more women, have more to do, give them badass character abilities and traits and scenes.
I think that might have been, you know, in wanting to get Thandi Newton back so much because of, like, what a, I thought what a cool character she turned out to. You know, at the end, at least, like, she's a spy. She was, like, a super spy. So here it feels like we took that relationship and sort of split it in half between Maggie Q and Michelle Monaghan, almost. Like, I'm just thinking, like, because, like, Michelle Monaghan and Tom Cruise sort of have that love relationship that he had in the last movie, and then yet she was also a spy, so they have the Maggie Q character. So maybe there was some more complications of them being married in the field. I don't know. My mind started going, like, cool places if Thandi Newton was actually in this, but then I was like, well, it's great that they were able to still populate it with, like, so many other women in this movie, too.
One of the things I like most about this movie is what it does with the whole idea of a professional spy, you know, marrying, settling down, and trying to live a normal life, right? Like, what's that going to do to that relationship if he's called back into the field and has to keep his whole
relationship? Spoiler, not good things.
Right. He believes that he can manage both things. Everyone's telling him he can't do it. Spoiler alert, he can't.
No, it's a house of lies. But, it's a house of lies.
But I love that this whole movie is essentially grappling with that question. I mean, the actual plot, which involves the rabbit's foot and all of that, is all to serve this particular idea of a spy trying to be married and have a wife and a normal life, right? Because if it wasn't for that, then there's no movie. All of the women do get opportunities to really shine in this movie. And I do think that they should be given more stuff. Although I wonder if Michelle Monaghan was given more to do in this movie, that it wouldn't accidentally become like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which is exactly what I wouldn't want this movie to be. So, and I don't know that J.J. Abrams is the guy who's going to thread that needle. You know, he's not exactly the guy who's going to subvert expectations. I am very happy all the women in this movie did get opportunities to really kick ass. But I would like to have seen more with Michelle Monaghan that didn't seem hammy.
I think everybody at one point sort of gets pushed aside, because even Philip Seymour Hoffman, right, he gets rescued on the bridge and then disappears for like an hour. Yeah, you know,
right.
Like he's in the movie for like 20 minutes, then he's gone, then he comes. So like, I feel like that way for everybody basically, except for Ethan Hunt.
Yeah. You know?
But, and yet I don't want any less of him either. I guess I'd just rather have him than better than nothing, I guess.
Right.
Like, I think Michelle Monaghan gets sidelined just narratively. I mean, it's the same, it's sort of the inverse of why Philip Seymour Hoffman does, like you were just saying, Mike, but I think there's a reason to it. It's still kind of a bummer as a viewer, but I understand why it happens. And I think at the end of the day, I think we all kind of need to assume or just understand that, like, this is a Tom Cruise movie, right? And that means something, as opposed to, like, it's not an action movie starring Tom Cruise, it's a Tom Cruise movie.
Right, and I think the franchise, over, like, beyond this movie, has done a much better job with its female characters. You know, it's always going to be the Tom Cruise show, but I think that the female members of his team have always been, have gotten increasingly better and more interesting. This is just the beginning of that trend. We got to judge it based on its own merit, but the franchise does do a better job with that, which is a great thing.
These are movies populated with lots of small roles, and like even from the jump we had, you know, John Voight was in the first movie for like a minute and then killed and then came back at the end, spoilers, but we're at part three already. I mean, and you got guys like Fishburne coming in this for like probably a total of like 3 minutes screen time. Mm-hmm. Everybody sort of got a small role, so we need these stronger actors in place to give them more weight in such a small amount of time, and I think everybody's really pulling their weight.
Now on the flip side, and I think we've all sort of alluded to things that we are not necessarily thrilled with about this movie, though I think it's safe to say that we all enjoy this movie, think it's all pretty good. Dan, what would you say is your least favorite part about this movie? What about this doesn't work for you? What would you change, remove, or swap out? What's your least favorite part of Mission Impossible 3?
I might have to have you come back to me, because there's nothing about this movie that really is a glaring flaw that I can think of. Like, I didn't watch it and have that, oh man, that this would be great if it wasn't for that thing.
All right, Mike, what about you?
I think I alluded to it twice already, maybe. And again, like, I do still really like this movie and enjoy it and stuff. But this sort of takes away some things, and I think it might some light might be shined on this in some of the trivia, maybe, because it all regards, like, the actual filmmaking of the movie. Like, I don't really have an issue with, like, any of the plot or the story or the action or, like, the acting or anything, but I don't necessarily feel like these action sequences, especially in the first half, I'm not really thrilled. I'm not really riveted. There's a lot of shootouts. There's a lot of darkness. There's a lot of fast camera work. They sort of go the Jason Bourne route with this, when I'm used to the more sort of the last two movies were just the shooting, like the sequences in those are just gorgeous. And here I just feel like it's been taken down a notch a little visually. And again, it's not like the worst thing like imaginable. Like I could, it's still watchable. There is a lot of shaky cam. I don't feel like the action sequences are as good as they maybe could be with a more seasoned director. I think he might bite off a little more than he can chew. The best one for me is the one on the True Lies bridge where he sort of, where the Philip Seymour Hoffman escapes. It's not like unwatchable or anything. It's just like kind of, I was a little disappointed, I guess, because I remember coming back to this being like loving this one, being like, oh, it's the best, like my favorite one, the best action. Like, and I was just sort of surprised to be like, oh, I do not really like the visual style of this movie as much as the last two. So, you know, not like the harshest thing, but just, you know, personal taste, I guess. It just didn't really click with me in that way for Mission Impossible.
No, I get all that. And I think my thing is another personal taste thing that I've also mentioned already is that, like, stop making movies that start in the beginning of the end scene. Like, what the fuck? what are you doing? Stop it.
It's like the best scene, too. Like, oh.
It's so frustrating that, like, it starts with a villain we don't know, with a woman we don't know, with Tom Cruise obviously in agony and dismay, and we're like, this means something, but we don't know what they're talking about. We don't know who these people are. I get that it's, like, tense, but stop it. Just stop it. This is not a J.J. Abrams thing. This is just a Hollywood thing. You know, it's the Don't Breathe-ification, even though this came way before Don't Breathe. It's just, you know, one of the most glaring, most egregious ones that I think that might have been the first time I actually pointed it out on that episode of Cinemakers that we did, Mike. But, like, stop it. Like, stop sort of shooting your proverbial load before you get to the scene. Like, if you want to start this off with Philip Seymour Hoffman, like, establishing him as this villain of your movie, go for it. Have him do something terrible or heinous or whatever to someone else, but don't cheat the end of the movie. That scene is a cheat too, because it's not actually Jules. Like, we don't yeah, know that. Yeah. I think the murder, like, you feel it because you're like, oh, like, I, you know she's not dead if you've seen later movies, but you think that in the moment she's dead because you see her on screen. And, like, I think that scene is effective in sort of making you forget about mask technology, right? Like, how did they have it, right? Like, it's just the good guys have it. And I think that is great. Like, I think the cheat there works. But don't cheat that scene by starting your movie there. Like, it's so frustrating. And I think I'm only going to get more angry as these keep popping up in movies, because you're only hurting yourself. Like, trust in the screenplay to get you there. Like, you're not learning new things. It's not like it's a different perspective. It's the same thing. What are you doing?
Okay, I'm going to be the lone voice of dissent here, clearly. I actually really like that the movie starts right where it starts.
Please explain why.
And I think it has to do with context, right? Like, this is the third movie of this franchise. People who are a little older may remember the Mission Impossible TV series, right? Ethan Hunt, he is James Bond just in this franchise. He is always going to make it out alive. He is always going to save the day. He's always going to win. With this particular opening, we know who Ethan Hunt is, and we see what we believe to be him losing. That's something that I have never seen before. Yeah, I mean, I've seen the rest of the franchise. We all know Michelle Monaghan lives and blah, blah, blah. But when I first saw this, you know, I didn't know what was coming. I watched that scene, and I loved being tossed into the middle of a scenario, not having any idea what was happening. But all I knew was at the end of it that Ethan Hunt fails. And I thought, oh, shit. Okay. And then I realized that, you know, once the main credits, you know, are over, oh, okay, that was a flash forward. What's going to lead to this? Like, how is that going to resolve? Like, I was so excited to see where that scene was going to go. I guess I don't entirely understand your qualm with starting in a scene like that and then, you know, going all the way back to the beginning. I thought in this particular movie it was very effective. Now, what might have worked better, you may enjoy this particular thing better, but if maybe they had started with the same type of scene, but that was unrelated to the movie that preceded it. There are a number of Bond cold opens where he's in the middle of a case or mission, and something happens. He finishes that mission, credits, and then he gets sent on the next thing.
I don't mind that. Like, I don't mind starting in media res. Like, Avengers Age of Ultron starts in the middle of a mission, right? Like, it's like this badass thing or whatever. Like, that's cool. Throw me into action. I love that. Don't cheapen your movie by throwing us into a scene we're going to see later. Like, it doesn't help me. Have Tom Cruise losing, but then something or whatever, and, like, have him start the movie in earnest by being retired and about to get married.
Right.
I don't think that this does anything good for your story. I like what you think, what you're able to grab from the scene narratively, that this is a new side of him, this is him losing. I love that. But I don't think that the actual showing of a later scene does anything. Like, if you're able to pull the same things in a different way, I think it's more effective. I don't think that there's any good that comes of it when you cheapen your own climax by showing it, like this is where we're going to get to. So what? Like, why are you spoiling that for me? Let it be a surprise.
Right.
Yeah, I almost wonder if this was the wrong scene to insert into the beginning and loop back to into the middle. Because I'm more on your side, Joey, like, all the time. Like, I just would rather sort of just get to it when it's intended. And, you know, this is, to me, the best scene of the movie. And if it came when it was, quote-unquote, supposed to in the screenplay, instead of, like, the truncated, awkward version that we get when it comes back around, you know, like, that's my major problem is, like, we don't really get the full scene when we need it. I would much rather have it be a surprise in the middle when he actually does show up with his wife, and because he makes that big threat, I'm gonna find her, I'm gonna kill her, she's gonna scream your name, and I'm gonna kill her in front of you, and all this kind of stuff. And, like, you know, that's him. He'll end up doing that twice, or having that opportunity twice. But, like, yeah, I don't know. I think personally, I if you want to show Ethan Hunt in a state of weakness, I think they did that by showing him getting engaged.
Yeah.
Quite honestly, that's enough for me to say he's lost. He's no longer a spy. Like, he has gotten soft. This is a situation I never thought I'd see him in. And yeah, introduce Philip Seymour Hoffman going after Kerry Russell, putting the bomb in her head. Show us that as the opening. And then to learn that she was trained by Ethan would bring the weight and the stuff that we need for him to go on mission.
I also think that, like, there's a sadness here, the way that the movie exists now, because I love that idea of having Kerry Russell. Like, it's still someone we don't know, still establishing, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman's villainy. This is, like, a cheesy movie thing that I just thought about. Like, Kerry Russell could, like, shout, like, Ethan, no, or, you know, whatever. Like, you could establish her tie in that scene or whatever in any number of ways. I think there's a sadness here to having Michelle Monaghan as a woman we don't know killed, and then we flash forward to the next scene, and it's, oh, that's the woman that Ethan's about to marry. Like, there's a sadness there, but I also feel like it cheapens her story. The sadness that you're supposed to feel, I think, by, like, oh, Ethan's actions led to this woman being killed, we know that it's going to be a tragic end because we see her or hear her die or whatever, we then see that who she is to him, but then the movie kind of undoes that by saying, oh, it wasn't really her anyway. And it's just a weird, like, what I think could be set up well, and, like, this kind of mechanic or this kind of effect or whatever that I would like, I think the movie undoes in that way. And I just don't like having it spoiled. Like, I think Mike's onto something in terms of other substitutions you could use, but that's just my problem with it, Dan, is that I don't like telegraphing or hinting at what's going to come or just showing you what's going to come. Like, let's get to that way organically, as opposed to, like, here's a sneak preview. Like, I don't need a movie trailer in the movie.
Yeah, no, I get the point you guys are making. I'm not feeling swayed, though. I still really like that opening. I don't necessarily agree that it cheapens that scene.
I mean, I think it works better here than in a lot of movies. I just hate it used in any movie.
Sure.
Because I really want, like, I think that this, in the grand scheme of things, is probably a better implementation than things, Mike, that you and I have talked about in other movies, but I don't like it here. I don't want to see that.
This is what I feel JJ does the best, and some may say, like, he did it too much in the new War Stars movie, but, like, he crafts a situation to get you to feel a certain way only for that moment. Like, it's literally just for that scene or that sequence, and then it's like, oh shit, I feel that way, and now on to something else, and it's like, oh, a party, okay, now I feel like I'm at a party. And, like, he's really great at just sort of, like, drop it, forget it, and now pick this back up kind of filmmaking. And I think that's totally fine. Like, that's a tough style to work, and he makes it work, and he's making it work in this movie. And I think that might just be a byproduct of his style, you know, and like trying to have like the whole mystery box thing. And it's like, oh, like, what is the rabbit's foot? Like, set that up. It's like the huge thing that all of this conversation and everybody's like tied to a chair, and it's the rabbit's foot. It's like, okay, the intrigue in this scene is definitely there. The characters are set, like everything is in place. But then like a few scenes later, it's kind of like washed away for me in a way. Like, there's nothing, no like permanence really beyond the moment. And I don't know if that's also just me, but it does work in the moment. I will say that much. Like, as I'm watching this movie, I'm going, oh shit, I don't know what's going to happen. But then, you know, a few scenes later, I think I'm sort of out of that moment for good. So
in other movies, you know, maybe this sort of a moment wouldn't work as well. But I think that a big part of why I'm like, why I love this opening could be partially due to Philip Seymour Hoffman. You know, if it was just some unknown actor and, you know, him against Tom Cruise, you know, maybe I wouldn't care as much. But this is a scene with Tom Cruise against Philip Seymour Hoffman completely out of context, and they're both delivering powerhouse performances. I'm willing to say that at least elevates that scene for me to something that I find really enjoyable, regardless of whether or not regardless of what it may or may not do to the rest of the film. I find that opening to be really compelling, if only for that.
Absolutely. So if that scene works for you, and that's something that, you know, Mike and I have issues with, have you thought of something that doesn't work for you? Is there a scene in here that you don't like that you would remove?
It's hard to pick something about this particular movie to sort of jump off of something I said earlier, the way that this movie sort of created a formula for future entries in the franchise. I think that the one thing I don't like about where the franchise has gone, starting with 3, is that everything sort of feels a little bit homogenized. This one's not a great example because Philip Seymour Hoffman's such a great bad guy, but you know, I look at the other movies and I feel like they're all following the formula, and the bad guys could all kind of be the same. And the mission itself isn't really that important. It's about stunts, and it's about this the fun interplay between the team, the IMF team. Those things that are enjoyable in the moment, you know, I think about the other entries now in my head, Fallout and Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation, and I can't remember what happens in each of them specifically. They don't have a specific identity. And that, I think, can be traced back to this particular movie, which I think on its own is really fun, but created a trend of that sort of homogenized product that I don't love. I don't know if that makes sense or not. It's not a specific complaint about this particular movie, maybe, but it's sort of where I see the genesis of that trend within the franchise.
I hear what you're saying there. Tom Cruise is now, he's like a producer involved in these, right?
So right.
Like, and Joey and I have discussed in the past how, like, you know, once he gets that name on, like, he's doing stunts. Like, these stunts are going to be bigger. Like, these movies are going to sort of be playgrounds for him. And we get, like, the roof jump in this or whatever, right? Like, it's already started, you know?
So, yeah.
And I think he even climbs another really tall building in another one, right? So they almost, like, redo some of this stuff again, even better or higher or during the day. So we mentioned like him getting on a plane and Benji being like, oh my God, he's on a plane now. I get where you're coming from for sure. It doesn't bother me per se. I'm just such a big fan. It just doesn't bother me. But like, I know where you're coming from.
Like, I'm not saying I don't enjoy them because, you know, like I looked at the other the ratings I gave the future entries and I like them more. I think I've given them up to 4 or 4.5 stars. But at the end of the day, I think back, like, which one was that? Was that the one where he climbs up the really tall building and then slams his face on the window? You know, like, I don't remember the plot so much as I remember the set pieces. It's fun in the moment. I don't know how much of a lasting impact these movies will have. And that's a little bit upsetting. Whereas, like I said, I'm a big James Bond fan. I look back at the franchise and they all feel very distinct to me. Maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just because I love that franchise. Maybe to other people, they all feel the same. I feel very much the same way about like the Fast and the Furious franchise. As much as I enjoy those movies as I watch them, I can't remember major plot points specific to a particular movie.
But I feel that way already even about the first one. And if you're saying the first one is different, like, I don't remember the plot of the first one, but I remember the train sequence.
The
I
knock
remember
list.
Him on the wire.
The knock list, yeah. Like, that plot makes, like, I remember that vividly, but maybe that's because I just love that particular movie so much.
But now, what's the plot of two? That I couldn't tell you, really. There's something about a virus.
Maybe it's because I've seen the first two way more than I've seen the rest of these.
That also might be the same one, like when we just recorded, I guess it came out a couple weeks ago because time is a flat circle, but we just recorded our Furious 7 episode with Kara, and Kara was like, I couldn't tell you what that movie's about. I'm like, it almost doesn't matter. Like, it matters, but it doesn't matter. But if you watch it enough, you know the plot. You know that there's God's eye and blah, 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 blah. But yeah. I feel like all action movies now have become spectacle. I think it's maybe lamenting just the industry as a whole, and I think that's totally fair. I think if this movie doesn't work for you in a way that those early ones do, if the first ones are more reminiscent of a Bond movie than the later ones, by all means, just, you know, enjoy the ones you love. Like, I'm not saying that one is better than the other. I think that there is something fun about the spectacle of it all. I think that's why people like me specifically like these later movies, is that scene from every commercial of Tom Cruise hanging off the plane, that's how Rogue Nation starts, right? Like, that's how the movie begins, and there's like five other scenes that are like bigger than that, and like, that's exciting to me. Like, I don't necessarily need to remember or need to care about the knock list or whatever. Like, in my head, I'm not thinking about Mission Impossible the first one as the one where he's trying to get the knock list back or whatever. I don't even know the plot, whatever, but as the one where he's like hanging from a wire, sweat about to drip on the ground, it can't drip on the ground, there's the red laser, it's him in the glasses. Like, it's the shots, it's the scenes, the set pieces, that even in the ones where the plot's driving it, that's still what sticks out to me. So I think it's just, you know, maybe the way that you watch it, which, again, not a bad thing, just a different way of watching it.
Yeah, maybe. And like I said, it may be that I just haven't seen these as much as some other people. All I can say is that, you know, as I watch them, I really, really enjoyed them. But they all kind of blend together, and I think that has to do mostly with, you know, the sort of J.J. Abrams effect of just sort of homogenizing this thing into one formula, like this one thing, and it all has to follow this, it all has to feel like this, and I don't necessarily love that. I wish the movies had a little more identity. I still really enjoy these movies, so it's and it sounds like I'm railing on them, but I'm just trying to find something to find negative.
No, I don't think you're railing on them at all. I think that you have been the kindest to all these movies, more so than me and Mike have been, I think, and we all are in agreement that we like this. I also do want to point out that Tom Cruise is a producer on every Mission Impossible movie, even the first two. So he was a producer all the way back from the beginning, so I think there have always been sort of, how do I get myself, you know, into these movies? How can I do crazy things in these movies? So.
Right. But like those first two, like the first one feels like distinctly like maybe De Palma. I mean, he directed it, so it feels like a De Palma film. The second one, John Woo directed that, and you can see the John Woo in there.
But this also feels like a JJ film.
Maybe. Yeah.
Right? For better and worse. Like, it feels like it's the style, it's the look, it's the glossiness.
But maybe I feel like the subsequent entries feel like they're trying to replicate that JJ style.
Like, it was tough to tell at the time because this is like his first feature film, I believe, or a directing job, or like major. So like, but this definitely feels and looks to me a lot like Star Trek or his Star Wars movies. Like, he's definitely, this feels like JJ to me, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Not that I'm ever necessarily going to be well equipped to speak about these things in later movies, but I haven't seen Ghost Protocol since it came out on Blu-ray. I haven't seen Rogue Nation since theaters. I haven't seen Fallout since I saw it twice in theaters, right? Like, I can't really articulate the visual style of that, and whether that's, you know, I feel like Christopher McQuarrie is probably doing things differently, but also maybe it is establishing a little bit of a blueprint than the way that, you know, to bring it back to Fast and Furious again, because that's what I know. Like, Justin Lin sort of established a visual blueprint with Tokyo Drift and sort of established it from then on, right? Like, in, even though you had James Wan and you had F. Gary Gray doing 7 and 8, like, it still kind of adhered to that visual style. And I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily. It might not feel as special or unique, but I don't think it's necessarily bad. It's just it's different.
Yeah, and I look at like Ghost Protocol as, you know, Brad Bird's first live action directorial effort. You know, like, up until that, he had done Pixar movies, right? Even though it does feel very visually in keeping with the sort of tone that J.J. Abrams had established, for a guy who had never directed live action, you know, actors before, it's an incredible effort. You know, I love Brad Bird. I think he can, like, he's just incredible. But I wish that he had established a more distinct visual style. But as a guy who jumped into this, never having done it, at the very least was able to keep it consistent with the previous installment. And I think that was an incredible effort.
In that same regard, we need to point out that this is J.J.'s first feature. that he'd only done TV stuff before then. So this is kind of a new ground for him, too. I know it's not necessarily the same thing as going from animation to live action, but it's also kind of brand new ballgame for him. And if this is, in fact, the movie that establishes the visual tone for the rest of the franchise, that's kind of even more impressive that you can have a guy who's never made a movie before come in and be like, oh, hey, biggest action franchise in the world, here's how we're doing it from now on. And I think that's kind of, you know, cool, too.
I don't think I realized that. Okay. Yeah. I will alter my judgment.
One other note that I made that I want to make sure we point out is that Aaron Paul was in this. He is Michelle Monaghan's brother. So a couple years before Breaking Bad, he was here. And I was like, is he just in the first scene that he comes back later as the guy who, you know, tipped off the enemy to where Jules is? But yeah, science. So that's cool. Mike, any other thoughts about Mission Impossible 3 before I do some trivia and then we do some games?
It was cool. I liked Billy Crudup in this, the original Dr. Manhattan, I guess, as it were. I didn't remember he was in this. I knew that as soon as I saw him, I remembered he was the bad guy, and I love how he plays the good bad guy. Like, I just like, if you look at him and his performance, like, he's doing things to help Ethan to, and it's like, oh, it's because, like, no, he's the bad guy. Like, I just like, he's such a background character, but he works so well, and to come back at the end like that, I think was really cool. I think the final note I had involved him when he gives him the disposable Kodak camera. I was like, oh, it's like the only thing that really dates this movie is, like, I don't think those exist anymore, and people are probably wondering, like, what the hell is that? Why aren't you just, like, that's a camera? What did you do with it? How'd you expose those pictures? Like, you drop them off where? Like a photo mat? Like, what? It just raises so many questions, but it feels more like a IMF tool now than like something for mass production. But
and Dan, what about you? Any other thoughts about MI3?
You know, like I said before, like a lot of J.J. Abrams installments in franchise films, he kind of breathes new life into something that was previously a little bit stale or just wasn't working. And I think that there's something to be said for that. This is my second to last favorite of this franchise, but I think that's by no means a detriment to the film. Yeah, I think this is honestly a pretty solid Mission Impossible film.
I think that this is, you know, the worst thing we can say about it, Mike, is that maybe it's not as good as we remembered or thought it could be, but yeah. Again, not bad.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's no Fate of the Furious. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's
Hey, let's not throw names under the bus here. But yes,
no, but isn't that the one, though? Because we like, I love using the comparison that, like, you know, even though I have to rank one of those Fast and Furious movies at the bottom, they're still, like, higher than most other movies I watch. But then you always say, like, 8 is always at the bottom. So, like, I'm just saying that. Like, it's just, I don't think we ever get an 8 with this entire franchise. Yeah, even at that level, like, they're all really good movies.
So here's some trivia about this movie. No surprise here that Tom Cruise did the vast majority of his own stunts in the film, but he did crack 2 ribs while turning at one point. So that's something. Paramount teamed up with the Los Angeles Times to promote this movie by putting tape recorders in 4,500 newspaper boxes. It's like when people opened it to get a newspaper out, it would say, your mission, should you choose to accept it, blah, blah, blah. Maybe go see the movie, I don't know. But a lot of them fell, and they were just visible on top of the newspapers. And so they had multiple bomb threats called in. And so the LAPD or bomb squad or whoever detonated multiple newspaper boxes because people were freaking out that they thought these were bombs. In spite of this, Paramount and the Los Angeles Times continued the promotion, so it did not stop them. So, okay.
That's awesome.
Two things, and this is, I sort of hinted at this a little bit earlier, and this is something we talked about last episode, Mike, when we talked about War of the Worlds. When War of the Worlds was being promoted, and Tom Cruise jumps on the Oprah couch, and apparently it made Steven Spielberg unhappy, and they haven't worked together since. This was the last film that Paramount would distribute between the Tom Cruise and Paula Wagner films that they made together. Paramount owner, Sumner Redstone, decided not to renew the distribution rights. Apparently, Redstone was disgusted by Cruise's recent antics, particularly the couch jumping. And then that's when Cruise and Wagner resurrected the United Artists Company, which had closed a few years previously. And then similarly, but not at all sort of similarly, around this time, South Park did the episode Trapped in the Closet, which is a Scientology episode, and Tom Cruise threatened to cancel publicity because Comedy Central owned by Viacom, which also owns Paramount, if Comedy Central did not pull that episode from reruns, he would not promote this film. And so they pulled the episode. I guess it hasn't re-aired since. This is, I feel like, kind of a tipping point, Mike, where we've been, not that we've been following his personal life, because he's been married a couple times by this point, blah, blah, blah. Things in his personal life are beginning to bleed over a little bit into the movie life. We're still not going to be covering that the way that we quote unquote should, maybe. I don't know. But it feels like it's sort of getting harder to separate, you know, personal life from professional life when you read the behind the scenes of the promotion or whatever.
That's exactly what I was just going to say. It just starts to become to the point where it's unavoidable. Like,
yeah.
As much as you want to try, like it's like the sun is still going to be in the sky and you need sunglasses. It's like, that's just going to happen, I think, from time to time now.
I don't think I realized that the couch thing impacted his relationship with Spielberg.
As we're recording this, our episode of War of the Worlds has not come out yet. On that episode, we talk about how he was supposed to be on the episode with Tom Cruise. Steven Spielberg was supposed to be there as well, and he had to do, I think, post-production work of some kind, and so he couldn't make it, and then Tom Cruise went on there and then just started jumping around. And so I think it was maybe a combination of just a lot of different things where he's just like, oh, this is not the way to that I want somebody, you know, representing my property or whatever.
Yeah, we do not want this kind of connotation with our license or our film.
Yep.
Yeah,
it's a bunch of what almost was, and this is what I was sort of saying at the very top. Well, J.J. Abrams was hired after Tom Cruise watched a bunch of episodes of Alias and was impressed. So I think that, you know, he was just like, let's do this guy. At one point, Kenneth Branagh was, I think this is maybe an early version of J.J., possibly. Kenneth Branagh cast as the villain, but then because of shooting delays, because of War of the Worlds, like, was surprisingly greenlit. Like, I think that just sort of came together very quickly. So this got pushed back, which I guess also kind of explains why it had been 4 years between the first two, but then 6 years to this one. Because I guess, you know, maybe it was going to come out 04, 05, whatever. Kenneth Branagh had to drop out to do a different movie because there were shooting delays here.
That would have been awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Kenneth Branagh. Tobin Eddington and I will go all day talking Kenneth Branagh.
Fingers crossed there'll be a Bond villain one day. Still got time.
I would love it. The man knows how to rock some facial hair. But not only that, he's a brilliant dramatic actor. I think he would have, if he were to play a villain in this franchise, he would add some much needed gravitas, or maybe not much needed, but much welcomed gravitas to the films.
You know, as a backup, though, you could do a lot worse than PSH.
Oh, yeah, that's not a slight at Philip Seymour Hoffman. I think he's also got incredible dramatic chops. And I think that works in this movie's benefit. But Branagh as a villain in this franchise would be spectacular.
Ang Lee was apparently attached to direct this at one point, and the version of that movie was going to be where they're destroying various wonders of the world, but they felt that right after 9/11, it was a little bit too much too soon, and so they drew that back. There was another version that Frank Darabont, he had written a version that was about trafficking human organs. So that was another, I guess, possible potential plot thread at one point for this movie. David Fincher was first tapped to direct, but he had to back out. I guess that would have been maybe the body parts, the human organs. And in that version, Sylvester Stallone would have been the villain, or he was courted, at least, to play the villain,
man.
Which would have been, you know, can you imagine Cruise against Stallone? Man, oh man.
Not in this.
Yeah. World.
Like, Stallone fits better in, like, Guardians of the Galaxy or that kind of thing. Like, he's a little too, sticks out a little too much.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if 2006 Stallone could pull that off.
Is it the same year as Rocky Balboa?
Oh boy, which was, I think, around the time of that Rambo movie too. Rambo 4,
Rambo that was 08, so it was a little before, a little after that, but yeah, it's still like the kind of the comeback tour, right, where he's
before he's Unk.
In the credits for this, J.J. Abrams thanks the Hanzo Foundation, which is just a shout out to Lost, which I think is pretty cool.
Oh, sick.
This was, you know, J.J.'s first feature film. $150 million budget at the time, maybe still possibly, I don't know, but probably not because, well, I don't know, was the most expensive film for a first-time feature film director ever. That's a lot of money. Like, this is very high stakes. I mean, not that he was new to the scene in any regard, but again, for a first movie, that's a lot.
Yeah, I think it was, he was pretty much a sure thing around that time because he had nothing but three hit shows at the time, which was Felicity, Alias, and Lost. And it was like, well, everything he touches turns to gold. So, like, what are we going to do? Let's give him a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems to be one of the first of that new breed of, like, let's pick somebody not out of obscurity necessarily, but, like, seemingly out of nowhere and give him a shot and see if he can do it. And it worked out.
Now, some cool stuff about the women in this movie. I mentioned that Thandie Newton was offered the chance to reprise her role, but she turned down. Her character was later turned into a new character named Leah Quint, and Carrie Ann Moss had been brought on to play that role. But then when J.J. Abrams took over directing the project, they rewrote the script, and her character was cut entirely, you know, thereby, I guess, getting rid of Carrie Ann Moss.
No Trinity.
Rachel McAdams, my girl, Rachel McAdams, turned down the role that went to Michelle Monaghan, so she was, I guess, almost Jules at one point. ScarJo, Black Widow, was pulled out. She was cast, and then later replaced by Kerry Russell, so I guess she was almost Lindsay. Oh. But again, this would have been after Lost in Translation, but before, where does she show up for the first time? Iron Man 2, right? So
yeah.
Before Widow, but, like, you know.
Many years later.
Kerry Russell, speaking of Kerry Russell, trained for 3 months for her scenes, but she was only in the movie for like 10 minutes. Like, just, I think, kind of the one action scene, which is awesome, but, like, that's a lot of time to spend training for, you know, one or two scenes. Other actors considered for the role of Lindsay, the Kerry Russell part, are Katie Holmes, which, Lindsay Lohan, wow. Alicia Cuthbert, and Jessica Alba. So basically, if you're trendy in 2005, you know, you're considered.
Yeah, I could see all of them playing that role.
And then two little weird bits of coincidence about the female actors in this movie. Michelle Monaghan and Kerry Russell, both born on March 23rd, 1976. Normally, you know, trivia that I would not mention because this is a Tom Cruise podcast, but, like, how weird is it that, like, two people were born on the same day and are in the same movie? Kerry Russell, Michelle Monaghan, and Maggie Q all voiced Wonder Woman in different animated features. So
that's cool.
In Wonder Woman 2009, Young Justice 2010, and Justice League War in 2014, which I think is kind of cool. This is obviously Philip Seymour Hoffman back from Magnolia. We covered him on with Cruise in another movie already. The last thing I want to mention, this is something I think we're going to talk about more in the next Mission Impossible movie, I think, Mike, when we have Jeremy Renner in here, speaking of Widow and speaking of the MCU. But apparently around this time, and I think due in large part to a movie that Dan mentioned earlier, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, there apparently were a lot of rumors going around at this point that Brad Pitt was going to replace Tom Cruise as the lead of the Mission Impossible franchise, which I think this movie does more so than any other movie, kind of leave it open to interpretation, like, will he be back? Will he be replaced? But apparently, I don't know if that was ever actual serious discussion, serious conversation. There was multiple people talking about, like, I guess it was like a big deal that, like, he might get replaced by Brad Pitt.
There's rumblings. It's weird because there's rumblings now that he might only do the next two and they're going to hand the franchise off to someone else. But, like, to me, it doesn't feel like something you could do with Bond at this point, because it's weird. In a way, I want it to be the continuing adventures of Ethan Hunt and just recast Ethan Hunt and this kind of thing. But then again, it would be so bold if they just handed it off to a whole new character and kept calling it Mission Impossible. So I guess I don't know what I want, and I just take whatever they're going to keep giving me from now on.
I would really not like to see Brad Pitt take over. I find him so much more interesting as a character actor than I do as a leading man.
I would agree with that. I mean, I also just, you know, love him and everything, so I wouldn't mind it, but I do agree that I'd rather see him in smaller. I also think that, like, everybody is kind of better in smaller roles, like, even the best actors, like, you know, we have podcasts about Nicolas Cage, better as a character actor. Keanu Reeves, better as a character actor. Shia LaBeouf, better as a character actor. Like, when you are able to flex your weird creative muscles, it turns out better. I think, you know, not having to shoulder the load, right?
Right. Even Tom Cruise. Like, I was just recently, a few months ago, talking about him in Tropic Thunder. Like, he's so good in that movie because he's Tom Cruise, not playing a Tom Cruise role.
Mm-hmm. I hear where you're coming from, Dan, because I like my Brad Pitt sharing the lead, like Fight Club or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, like those kinds of roles. Not so much like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, you know, he's sharing the lead there and stuff. But and then, like, when you get him in Ad Astra, like, what, the reason I guess I love him in that so much is because it's just him, maybe, like, for the most part, you know? I mean, there's nothing else to really, like, kind of center focus on for that long, so it worked for me. But I hear where you're going for. I don't really, in a weird way, I don't see him as an action guy. I never did, and I don't think he really is.
Right.
In that regard, Mike, we could have a movie where it's Cruise and Brad Pitt, and they're sharing focus. I think that could work, right? But I don't know.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
So very important questions. The answer to the first one, of course, does he run? Of course, Tom Cruise runs this movie. But a better question, a question we asked you when you were on for Minority Report, Dan, we found someone on Twitter, Harperfect, who said you could replace Tom Cruise's character in any movie with the name Lightning McQueen and not a thing would change. Now, we've had some mixed opinions on past Mission Impossible movies. Do you think, And here's the sales pitch. And Mike, I want you to contribute to the sales pitch since we are doing this differently now. Here's the sales pitch to you, Dan. So we're going to replace Ethan Hunt's name with Lightning McQueen. The way that I see it happening, it doesn't really make a difference. I think it's fine. Ethan Hunt could be a code name. We don't know if it's necessarily... And we also know, what do we learn in the first movie, right? Like, it's not even his name.
Oh, well, so, like, Ethan is his mother's maiden name.
Yes.
So he has two last names. Like, his parents, if you look on his credentials, his name is... His mother's maiden name is Ethan. So they named their son Ethan Hunt. It's so bizarre.
So in that regard, you know, she could have been Mrs. Lightning or Ms. Lightning, right? And it's fine. So I think in that regard, I think anything is possible. I think Lightning McQueen is a totally fine IMF agent. Mike, do you have anything to add before Dan renders his verdict?
You know, it also could have been like his new civilian identity when he left the IMF. I don't know how he's even able to keep calling himself Ethan Hunt to his fiance and all that kind of stuff. It's like, no, my name's Lightning and I'm so damn charming and I'm going to bore you with all of this bullshit about my fake job. You're just going to totally like gloss over the fact that my name is Lightning McQueen and we're all just going to get along with it and accept it because that's the way it is.
So Dan, what do you think? Could he be Lightning McQueen in this movie, in this franchise, or no?
It's a little bit of a complex answer. I think that if we're talking about the franchise overall, there's so much ridiculous stuff happening in this movie in the franchise. Having your main character be named Lightning McQueen would not necessarily feel out of place. Overall, my answer would be yes. But if we're talking about like specific entries, like the first Mission Impossible movie, that is just too serious for that sort of a name. If that makes sense, I think that as a whole. The franchise and conceptually, it could support a main character named Lightning McQueen. But that first Mission Impossible movie, the De Palma movie, I don't think it could.
That's enough of a yes for me. I'm going to write down yes.
Yeah, I would say overall yes.
Wonderful. That's all I needed to hear. Thank you so much. All right, Tom Cruise Awards, maybe the Golden Masks. I feel like we almost have to do something Mission Impossible related, right? Like the Golden Missions? Yeah. That's still not a thing.
Yeah, because they used to, in the TV show, I think it was always like the same thing. Like it was a tape or something. In this, do we even get the wick of the dynamite? I don't even think we get that in this. So I don't know.
In the titles?
In the title,
yeah. In the titles.
Yeah. The Golden Destructibles? We'll work on it.
We'll work on it.
Best film, worst film? No, I think it's, again, like we've been saying all along down the middle. Best Cruise role? We already have this nominated. Most badass role? We already have this nominated. Best fight. Is there a fight in here that we want to nominate to stack up against all the fights in this career? You know, an actual fist fight or a battle or something? Is there something in this movie, best fight?
I think the fight he has with Philip Seymour Hoffman is really good. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it's going to top his fight with Henry Cavill.
No, I don't think it will either. But what's cool about it is that it's Philip Seymour Hoffman beating the shit out of Tom Cruise. Like, it's so surreal on that level that it just like amps it up, and then Tom Cruise doing those weird elbow punches and
that was so cool. Where he's
like some
his head
strange
in pain.
Moves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Love it. Best theme song, soundtrack, score. We have the franchise already down. Best car chase race. Is there there's the car where Maggie Q learned to drive for this movie. She drives here, but I don't think there's really a car chase. Is there?
Quite.
I would say
the helicopter chase, I think. But
the helicopter chase is pretty badass.
All right, so maybe I have to change this to the best vehicle chase race.
Because I think the car chase is cool. Oh, man, I don't know that I would go out of my way to recommend that. The helicopter chase is pretty badass, though.
I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We also are going to have another helicopter chase in Fallout, right? Where he's
Jesus Christ. And we already had one in the first movie where it chased the train. I can't believe that helicopters are so big in this franchise.
Best dance scene. I do not think he dances, does he?
I don't think so.
He does dance with Michelle Monaghan at the house party, but it's nothing impressive.
Best outfit wardrobe for Cruise. I don't think there's anything here
not
that's particularly... I mean, a Philip Seymour Hoffman suit, but again, that's kind of cheating, I think.
Wait for Ghost Protocol. That suit's awesome.
Best sunglasses... No?
I don't think he wore any.
No.
Best death. We have to mark it down here again.
Oh, my God. What is this, the third time?
Defibrillated.
Dies and comes back.
I'm going to die unless you kill me is one of the best things I've ever heard, ever.
Yes. So I do want to say that line I'm going to nominate for best line.
Is there another actor in Hollywood that has died and come back to life so many times on camera? Like, this is the third fucking time that this has happened.
No. Mike, it's more than that. Hold on. I got to write this down.
You mean not Boris Karloff or Jason Voorhees.
Exactly. Not any like horror related characters or actors playing characters and stuff. Like Tom Cruise in movies has literally died and come back to
Mike,
life.
It's happened 7 times already.
Oh my god.
Where he's died in 7 films where he wasn't actually dead. And I'm not going to spoil, I mean I guess I could spoil them. So spoilers if you don't know, if you've not listened to every episode. Interview with the Vampire, twice. Vanilla Sky, twice. Mission Impossible 3. Mission Impossible 2, where he's masked and Tom Cruise, the actor, dies on screen.
Right.
You see him killed on screen.
Yeah, and Far and Away. Counts. So it happened 7 times over 5 movies.
Insane. Jesus, right? Like, I mean, he thinks he's Jesus in movies. It's crazy. He dies and comes back to life.
Best line, I did nominate what I mentioned earlier, what Dan just said. I have a charge in my head. I'm going to die unless you kill me. Mission Impossible 3, which I just love.
Great, great line.
Best freak out. Is there a freak out in here worthy of nominating? I don't know.
Doesn't he say, like, you're freaking out? Like, doesn't Philip Seymour Hoffman, like, say, like, oh, you're really freaking out right now or something when he's in the chair with the Michelle Monaghan girl with the mask? I don't know. I guess it's not worthy enough because it's not like the movie stops and he jumps on a couch and he's, like, freaking out or anything.
Best sex scene, no. Most athletic feat, do we want to say? Oh, dude. I do want to say him jumping off a building on that wire in Shanghai.
The fulcrum.
But also, the amount that he must have had to run just for that shot, or 2 or 3 shots when he's running through the street. You know, where he, like, jumps off the 2 buildings and he starts booking it, like, down the street. And he's like, move, move. And he's on the phone and he's talking to Benji.
Running, like, to rescue Jules in Mission Impossible 3.
Oh, my God. I was getting...
Oh, no. That. Hold on. Sorry. We're gonna put that in the next one. That's in the best running scene.
Oh, right. There can't be 2.
Running to rescue Jules in Mission Impossible 3. So there we go. Best love story. So we have Ethan and Naya in Mission Impossible 2. I think we got to have Ethan and Jules in Mission Impossible 3.
Yeah, this is much more developed.
The love story in this movie is the movie. If it wasn't for his attachment to his wife and his desire to have a marriage and a normal life, then he wouldn't have been, we wouldn't have the movie that we have. So I think that this is hands down mostly about the love story that he has with his wife.
Best ensemble cast. I'm gonna say yes. I think that we had been hinting at it for a while. But I think the addition here of Benji, I think Maggie Q, I think Kerry Russell, I think bringing in Michelle Monaghan, especially adding in Philip Seymour Hoffman, Billy Crudup, Lawrence Fishburne. Like, this is great.
Stacked.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final thing, best non-Cruise actor, male or female. We already have Ving Rhames as Luther in the entire franchise. Is there anybody else that we want to nominate? Do we want to say Philip Seymour Hoffman? Oh, we have him as Phil Parma. Yeah, right? Probably.
Yeah, I guess we gotta.
So Ian Magnolia and Mission Impossible 3. Anybody else, male or female, we want to nominate here? I don't know if we should nominate. Like, I don't know that Michelle Monaghan has enough to do here yet, but we'll have to see in later movies if she establishes herself compared to, you know, Nicole Kidman or Diane Lane as Cherry Valance. This female, like, it's all sort of smaller roles. But yeah, I think we will see. We will see.
We'll get there.
But yeah, there's a bunch of nominations here. Best fight we have. Best vehicle chase race. Best death, best line, most athletic feat, best running scene, best love story, best ensemble cast, and best non-Cruise actor male, plus the stuff that we nominated for the entire franchise. So, again, for a movie that none of us were super crazy about but all enjoyed, this is it did pretty well.
Yeah.
And I guess in that regard, it's just a good Tom Cruise movie, right? Because there's a lot of things that we keep an eye out for that he does. So, but Dan, thank you so much for joining us here on Cruise Club once again to talk about this movie. You'll be back on our other TomTom Club, the Hanks for the Memories podcast, in a couple of months to talk about The Green Mile, but thank you so much for joining us today on Cruise Club.
Always a pleasure, Joey. Thanks for having me.
And you, well, let's see here. Are you going to be back on any more cruises? I don't think so. I think this might be your farewell to cruise. We got a couple, at least, more Hanks for the Memories coming up, so go check out that. Or go to cageclub.me and search Dan Colon and find all the episodes that he has been on with me and Mike and other podcast as well, especially on, he's been sort of your resident horror expert over on Third Time's a Charm, so there's a bunch of episodes there. But go to cageclub.me/shows, poke around, or just go to facebook.com/cageclub or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, run@cageclub.me. Come back next week on Hanks for the Memories. On Fridays are for fun for Saving Private Ryan. Come back in 2 weeks. Ooh, we're sort of slowing it down here a little bit. Maybe not. I don't know what this movie's about. One of the very few that we have left that I've not seen, Mike, but Lions for Lambs.
Wait, what?
Oh, I've seen that.
No, this one.
I've seen that one.
But yeah, that's one of the very few Tom Cruise movies that are left that I have not seen, so that's going to be very exciting, I guess, for that regard alone, in 2 weeks. Go to cageclub.me/shows, poke around, close to 1,400 episodes, including 28 now of Cruise Club. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Dan Colonna. We'll see you next time right here on Cruise Club.